I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. It's estimated that 6 million Americans suffer from dementia caused by Alzheimer's disease, which has devastating effects on the millions of caregivers who are largely responsible for the person's well-being and quality of life. With more people living longer, those numbers are expected to grow, which explains the desperation to find a treatment to slow the decline of the brain disease, maybe even prevent it and cure it. Yesterday, the FDA ruled on a controversial new drug, aducanumab, saying it could slow the progression of cognitive decline. I say controversial because the company Biogen announced 2 years ago that the drug did not improve memory and thinking and then amended those findings. Last fall, an FDA advisory committee rejected Biogen's application, saying the evidence that it helped patients just wasn't there. Well, here to sort things out is Jason Karlowicz. He's co-director of the Penn Memory Center, where he treats Alzheimer's patients. He's also a professor of medicine, medical ethics, and health policy and neurology at the University of Pennsylvania. And he's got a new book. It's called The Problem of Alzheimer's, How Science, Culture, and Politics Turned a Rare Disease into a Crisis and What We Can Do About It. Jason Karlowicz joining us here in our Philadelphia studios. Nice to have you with us.
Thanks,
on Radio
Marty.
Times. We've got a lot to talk about. Before we get to this new drug, I want to put some definitions on the table because, frankly, reading your book, I think we don't all know what Alzheimer's is. So explain what it is. This is a disease of the brain.
It is a disease of the brain. And the most common question that this disease causes people to ask, much like the symptoms of the disease, is what's the difference between Alzheimer's disease and dementia? Right. So here's how I like to think about it right now based on how we understand those two terms. Dementia describes disabling cognitive impairments. So someone has troubles with memory, multitasking, spatial function, and those problems with those cognitive abilities are causing a disability. So persons with dementia are, and the operative word here is, they're disabled, much like someone, say, with a spinal cord injury. Except here, the disabilities aren't physical disabilities, but they're disabilities as a result of cognitive impairment, troubles managing money, preparing a meal, traveling from home to a restaurant, and then ordering off of the menu. That's dementia, disabling cognitive impairments. Right. Alzheimer's disease is one of the more common diseases that causes dementia, but it's not the only disease that causes dementia. Robin Williams, the comic actor, had Lewy body disease. Frontotemporal disease causes a different dementia. But the common theme across all those diseases is disabling cognitive impairments.
Take us inside the brain, then, of someone with Alzheimer's disease. What do we see? What's going on in there?
Well, until not too long ago, once upon a time, but not too long ago, we couldn't go inside the brain of a person with dementia until they died.
Yeah.
And there was a sort of dark irony to the diagnosing persons with dementia, namely, I won't be able to tell you what caused your dementia until you die, until I do a brain autopsy, which, of course, is a dark irony because you'll be dead. And then events happen, and I chronicle them in The Problem of Alzheimer's, beginning around the turn of this century. We are now here, now in 2021, we can see the pathologies that cause Alzheimer's disease in the brain of a living human being. Using imaging and or other tests of spinal fluid, we can see the plaques of amyloid,
right,
and we can see the tangles of tau protein. Those are the two sort of putative causes of the destruction of neurons. So what was once invisible until death is now visible in life. And as I note in the book, this is a radical transformation in the way we understand the disease. No longer do you have to wait till you die and have dementia and then die. Now we can look for the disease even when you have the most mildest of symptoms using these other tests, these scans.
And the two operative words, plaques and tangles, right?
Plaques of amyloid, which were first seen in 1906, and tangles of tau, which were also seen at the same time, though, of course, at that time, Dr. Alois Alzheimer's didn't know it was amyloid and tau. But he and his colleagues, and they were all German, were brilliant psychiatrists and microscopists, and they really were onto stuff early in the 20th century, that there's something going on in these older adults who we said have senility, extreme old aging. But actually, these gentlemen, and they were all men, were saying, actually, we're seeing something in these brains that looks like a disease. And that's in the early 1900s. Stuff happened in between in Germany that destroyed Germany and destroyed the science. But yes, you're right, beginning again in the late 20th century, amyloid was identified as what those plaques were, and then a little bit later, the tangles were identified as a protein called tau.
And what happens to the brain? I read there's a kind of a shrinking of
exactly.
the brain.
Exactly. Yeah, the operative word is atrophy. Mm-hmm. Namely, as the disease develops, beginning in certain regions of the brain, most commonly in a region that controls memory, but not only there, brain cells start to die. If you do a MRI scan that looks for the structure of the brain, you'll see that those regions are not as large as you would expect compared to the other. And the operative term there is atrophy. And so that shows you what we call, in our phrase, a marker of neurodegeneration. Neurons are degenerating.
And that explains the diminished cognition.
Precisely.
Mood change. I mean, all the things that
Precisely.
Are observable from the outside.
One of the key things, you know, the stereotype word that is attached to Alzheimer's is memory, loss of memory, the ability to encode new information, store it away, and then retrieve it, to speak like an amateur psychologist. Mm-hmm. And certainly Alzheimer's often presents with trouble with memory, repetitious questions, stories, troubles remembering the day of the week, common early signs. But there are other ways that Alzheimer's can present. Bill Lyon, the sports writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer, wrote very openly about his Alzheimer's disease. He was a hero.
Yeah.
And his presented with visual spatial problems initially, depth perception. This is a totally different location of the disease. There's a language variant that begins with troubles with speech and language, and there's a dysexecutive variant that's troubles with problem solving. Four different clinical presentations. Common pathology is those plaques and tangles.
I think a lot of older people, and I guess I have to include myself in that, often feel as if, you know, our memory is not what it used to be when mm-hmm. we were younger. The sort of code word is, well, my, you know, the hard drive is full. I just can't stuff any more information in there. What is that? I mean, is that does that sort of diminishment of memory and even cognition, does that just come with age, even if it's not Alzheimer's?
So there is a real phenomena across a variety of mammals called cognitive aging. Namely, in the absence of disease, plaques and tangles, et cetera, cognition does change over time. It's highly variable within whatever species you're looking at. Some individuals have changes, others don't. And the common theme is a slowing of what we call fluid intelligence, the speed of processing, the speed of taking in things. When people are time pressured, they'll start to make mistakes in terms of recall, troubles finding words. Once things slow down, generally people do okay. That's cognitive aging, and we know even the neurobiology of that related to frontal lobe function. The changes that you see, though, with these diseases like Alzheimer's disease, first are oftentimes similar, but the key thing is, A, they progress over time and to disability, and B, if you measure the pathologies I've talked about, you will see those as opposed to someone who's only having cognitive aging.
Well, let's talk about what the FDA did yesterday.
Yes.
They approved this new drug, controversial is the word that I use, and I saw a lot of other people using it as well, because it doesn't seem like a slam dunk at all. Help us understand what this drug is purported to do.
Yeah. Well, so you're right. Even the most enthusiastic proponents don't call it either a cure or a reversal, but has some effect on changing the rate of trajectory. That's the claim by even the most enthusiastic proponents.
Right.
So the drug is called aducanumab, and the drug targets amyloid. That is to say, it binds to amyloid and removes it from the brain. The hypothesis, which I think is a very tight, attractive hypothesis, is if you can remove amyloid from the brain of a person with either mild cognitive impairment or dementia, you will slow down, reverse, halt, the process. That was the promise of the drug, as well as many other drugs that have been studied. And in the beginning, in 2016, it started with a bang, but subsequent studies of the drug involving more individuals have led to a data set that is controversial. And some of the reasons why the data set is controversial have to do with some business decisions. Namely, the studies were halted early on the basis of futility analyses. FDA was given the data they were giving, and we can talk more, obviously, about that data and the result there. But I just want to emphasize that aducanumab is just one of several different kinds of drugs that go after amyloid. And in the last several years, some of those drugs are really looking promising. But I and my colleagues, I think, all agree more study is needed. This decision is a bit premature, and certainly we'll talk about that.
Well, let's talk about it now.
I mean,
premature in that, I mean, the FDA Advisory Committee basically rejected the application.
Yeah, so let's go back to November 2020, the FDA convened an advisory committee, and Biogen and the FDA presented their case that the drug had a clinical benefit. Now, clinical benefit is my talk for basically patients' health and well-being. So things we do to measure the health and well-being of a person with Alzheimer's disease is not just their cognition, but their day-to-day function. So FDA presented those data to the advisory panel, and the advisory panel voted nearly unanimously that the data did not support that it was clinically beneficial. Obviously, FDA and Biogen felt differently. And many in the field share that view, that the data are provocative, but they're not a clear evidence of benefit. Okay, November 10th.
And benefit would mean less impairment.
Less disability.
Less disability.
Yeah. The bottom line in this disease, never, ever, ever forget that the operative word with Alzheimer's disease is disability. And I think once you see it as disability, you start to see how these people need reasonable accommodations, which gets us, for example, to the needs of their caregivers who are their, if you will, excuse the phrase, wheelchairs. That's what a caregiver is in some sense. I realize that's a rude phrase. We'll turn to that in a moment, but back to aducanumab. Yeah, it's all about disability and that the drug slowed the relentless disabling cognitive impairments. Well, the FDA's advisory board said no, and also the FDA's consulting statistician within the FDA, independent statistician Tristan Mazzi, he also concluded that the data did not support approving this drug for sale. Well, here we are, and the drug was approved. But how it was approved was not on the basis of the clinical benefit. The FDA instead picked an entirely different regulatory mechanism called fast-track designation. This was never discussed with the advisory panel, but instead was, I guess, a series of private, non-public conversations of what do you think about fast-track designation.
What does that
mean? And simply put, fast-track designation means that the drug was approved because it has an effect on a surrogate, not on a clinical measure, and that there is reasonable likelihood that change on that surrogate will predict benefits to patients. What is the surrogate in question? Amyloid. Reducing amyloid will translate into benefits to patients. The analogy that many will offer is elevated low-density lipoprotein, reduce it with a statin drug, less likelihood of having a heart attack. Elevated glucose, reduce it, less likely at having the complications of diabetes. I mean, I think hypertension. We could run the list of all the many surrogates that are out there that are widely used in clinical practice. Amyloid, though, while used to diagnose Alzheimer's, I think most reasonable experts feel has not yet arrived at the status of a surrogate with the eminence of low-density lipoprotein, high blood pressure, bone mineral density, glycosylated hemoglobin. And that's, I think, where the problems begin with the FDA's approval, because they've put the drug out onto market now. Market means just what it means. It's for sale, although we can get to that.
We should.
But they've also required under this accelerated approval process that additional study must be done, which means another, they say in their statement, a randomized controlled trial. Now, how we're going to do a randomized controlled trial while the drug is also available for sale presents an enormous number of challenges. And at this point, I simply don't know the answer to that, but that's not my job.
That's my music they're playing. We're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation with our guest, Jason Karlowish. We're talking about the FDA's decision to approve a drug related to Alzheimer's. He's got a new book. It's called The Problem of Alzheimer's. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Let me just recap what we're talking about. The FDA approved the use of a controversial Alzheimer's drug, aducanumab, on Monday. This is the first drug approved to treat Alzheimer's in over two decades. Our guest, Jason Karlowish, is co-director of the Penn Memory Center. We're talking about this decision, why it has generated such controversy and debate. We also want to talk about the state of Alzheimer's research and treatment, particularly some of the ethical issues raised with the disease and the toll that Alzheimer's takes on caregivers. And again, he covers some of that in his new book called The Problem of Alzheimer's. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. So just to recap, so what Biogen is saying is that this drug could, I guess that's the operative word, slow the decline associated with Alzheimer's, because it goes after this, the plaques, I guess.
The amyloid
plaques in the brain. It's an injection, apparently. It's a monthly injection, and the cost is something like $56,000
a year. So Biogen
has
stated that they feel that they price the drug's annual cost per patient at $56,000 a year.
Does that seem like a lot of money?
Compared to other biologics, it's within the range. That kind of cost demands what's its value, and certainly that's going to be the next act in this story.
You wrote something in about a month ago about this decision that was coming. You wrote, aducanumab is not the drug to launch a new era of Alzheimer's treatment. It hasn't been properly studied, and so the FDA has incomplete data to form a judgment. The cause of this is a series of decisions that were good for business, but bad for science and patient care. You deal with patients. How are you going to deal with this?
Well, I didn't want FDA to approve it. I wanted another study to be done. I guess FDA split the middle Solomon's baby, if you will, and said, we'll approve it, but we also want another study to be done. Anyway, it's approved. All right. I live in America. It's a liberal democracy. I have to respect the principle of respect for autonomy. With a drug out there, I am willing, after I educate a patient and their family about the uncertainties of its benefits, its risks, its hassles, and potentially they need to know about any copays, I'd be willing to write a prescription for it. I'm not an enthusiastic prescriber. I'm an enthusiastic researcher of the drug. But, you know, again, I have to respect that in matters of taste, it's a personal choice with a drug like this out there. So, yeah, I will prescribe it. But, again, I'm not an enthusiastic prescriber.
Yeah. With caveats, obviously.
Yeah, with education. You know, again, there are plenty of drugs out there for devastating diseases that carry risks, but the evidence of their benefit, I think, is more solid.
Here's a tweet: at $56,000 a dose, who could even afford this treatment?
Well, that's the question. I don't know who tweeted that, but whoever tweeted it is spot on. The next act in the story of aducanumab, the drama of aducanumab, is that it's the ball has been handed now to CMS, to Medicare. And I think this is going to result in a national coverage decision process, because what Medicare has to decide is, when they're handed a service, in this case a drug, for the treatment of patients, is that service reasonable and necessary given the payment needed for it? And I think this drug presents challenges about whether it's reasonable and necessary, because I think there are real challenges about knowing which patients are going to benefit and how you'll know that they benefited from it.
Right. Here's a related comment from Shelley. Could people possibly begin taking the drug before an official Alzheimer's diagnosis?
Shelley is spot on to the history of Alzheimer's.
Our listeners are,
Once upon a time, Shelley, you had to have dementia to be diagnosed with Alzheimer's. The discovery of mild cognitive impairment moved that diagnosis into a pre-dementia but still cognitively impaired stage. The addition of biomarkers firmed up the ability to diagnose someone in the MCI stage. Mm-hmm. The goal is, of course, to try and diagnose people before they have any disabling cognitive impairments. The operative term now, and it's a quirky term, it's called preclinical Alzheimer's. I think most in the field agree that we haven't yet validated what kinds of measures will correctly identify someone who's on that trajectory of developing cognitive decline. One of the key ways you validate that is you do a clinical trial with a drug in people who are cognitively unimpaired. And those trials are going on right now. We're doing several of them at the Penn Memory Center. With the arrival of this drug now on the market, labeled only for Alzheimer's disease, you could make the argument, well, if you've got plaques and tangles, no matter what your cognitive function is, you should take this drug. I'm just making an argument. The data aren't there to support that will benefit you, but it's out there now. And so, you know, the story of this drug in terms of access, off-label prescribing could turn out to be a rather fraught story.
Well, let me ask you about plaques and tangles. Is
amyloid
it possible?
Plaques and tangles.
Yes. If someone is in the early stages of Alzheimer's, do they have these plaques and tangles, but it just isn't affecting them?
In our studies where we follow people for years and years and years and years, you can see a natural history unfolding of an initial presence of small amounts of tangles of tau protein in the medial temporal lobe, the beginning of accumulation of amyloid, and then the rapid accumulation of amyloid, and then the uptake, rapid spread of tau. And it follows a natural history. About 10 years into that process, cognitive impairment starts to develop. At first, just inefficiencies. It takes longer to do things, making mistakes, but catching them on things like bill paying, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And those inefficiencies start to transform into disabilities, namely, as I said, dementia. That is a classic story of the disease. Where we haven't reached quality data yet is to know when those tests should be done, what precise results of those tests define a person who's on that trajectory. We will get there. I am confident that we will get there with our research. Are we there right now in June 2021? No. Will we be there in the next several years? I think so. This drug introduces some challenges to that, but, you know.
Is Alzheimer's a disease of aging?
Well, the older you are, the more likely you are to get it, similarly with osteoporosis. So is osteoporosis a disease of aging? Yeah. Is a bone mineral, is a bone fracture devastating and deadly for some? Absolutely. So, yeah.
So with this aging population, and not just in this country, but globally, we're going to see more Alzheimer's.
Yes, and we have, absolutely. I mean, the numbers of patients with Alzheimer's disease have only been increasing over time. But here's a very interesting story. Over the last 40 years, the risk of getting Alzheimer's disease, of getting dementia, has actually been declining. There's still plenty of people with dementia because age is one of the chief risk factors, and there are more and more people over 80. But the risk has been declining, and the answer to why the risk has been declining, and this is seen across multiple well-done studies, is access and opportunity. The more people have access to education, quality education, up through about high school and slightly beyond, the more they have access to good health care, particularly cardiovascular health care, the less likely they are in their later life to develop dementia. I still have plenty of PhDs in my practice who have dementia, but the argument is they were less likely to develop it or late developed it later because of this access and opportunity. So the story of dementia in America, as well as other developed nations, is the story of a life course of access and opportunity. And so therefore, for those who haven't had access and opportunity in this country, it translates often into issues around race and class,
sure,
is the story of being more vulnerable to develop dementia.
So lifelong learning, sort of overall health care, reducing heart disease, all those things.
I mean, a key set of events in the decades before you're elderly are those decades when heart disease starts to develop. And if you have access to be able to diagnose and treat your heart disease, you're less likely later in life to develop dementia. So imagine folks who pre of our Affordable Care Act didn't have access to consistent health care. So you see what I'm getting at. Imagine folks who over the course of their lifespan didn't have the opportunity, time to exercise. I mean, you could just add up the sort of systemic, relentless inequities that can lead in later life to the diseases of aging.
Does that run in families, this Alzheimer's?
Well, yes, there's a genetic element to Alzheimer's disease. There's no question. We've identified several genes that increase your likelihood but don't guarantee, excuse the phrase. Right. Doctors are often talk favorably of diseases.
We get the irony
So diseases progress, you know, as if they get better or whatever.
Yes, right.
But anyway.
Like the uneventful birth, but yes.
Indeed, exactly, right. Yes. So ApoE gene, particularly the ApoE form, makes one more likely in later life to develop Alzheimer's disease, but does not guarantee it. I always like to point out the twin studies. Identical twins, they share the same genome. One has dementia, the other is her caregiver, and obviously doesn't have dementia. So, you know, even folks who share the same genome, it doesn't destine that you're going to develop the disease.
Yeah. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That is Jason Karlowish, our guest on Radio Times today. He's got a new book. It's called The Problem of Alzheimer's, How Science, Culture, and Politics Turned a Rare Disease into a Crisis and What We Can Do About It. He's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania and co-director of the Penn Memory Center. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can always tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can pick up the phone and give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Here's a comment from Dave. I have Alzheimer's in my family. I've seen family members suffer from it. I will pay anything to avoid this fate. Am I part of the problem leading to the high price? It's a pretty
profound question. It's not your fault.
No, but
you know,
I think you get what he's
driving
at.
Yeah, no, I get the sentiment, and I feel you, Dave. Look, desperation should drive the funding of science. And in the case of this disease, lots of it. And I will give Congress credit. Over the last 10 years, they have poured money into this disease, into the NIH. And that is courtesy of brilliant advocacy work by the Alzheimer's Association. And we need to pour money into creating a workforce, both to do more research and care. Desperation should drive the desire and the funding. Desperation, though, should not drive the interpretation of science. And I think one of the problems we're facing here is desperation drove the interpretation of these data and have led to where we're at with this approval.
Let's talk about caregivers, because I think it is so often true that it's family members or close relatives or even
the
neighbors,
first,
friends.
The first public service announcement the Alzheimer's Association issued was Walter Cronkite, the America's most trusted newsman. And the PSA was, right now in America, this is like in the late 1980s, there are 4 million persons with Alzheimer's disease. But for every one of them, there's a wife, a husband, a daughter, a son caring for them. So right from the get-go, the Alzheimer's Association advocacy emphasized the needs and the sufferings of the patients and the needs and sufferings of the caregiver. And you're right. I think, in some sense, as I get back to my original remarks, because of the nature of the disabilities of the disease, early and relentlessly, it creates the need to basically fill in for the mind of the other person where it's not working well. And that role is done by a caregiver, by another human. And I would argue that we as a society in this country have not been successful in addressing the needs of caregivers as we ought to have been.
I know people who have been caregivers for parents with Alzheimer's or spouses or loved ones, and the emotional toll is almost hard to describe because of the sort of constant vigilance that you have to have.
Yeah.
The sadness of watching someone that you love and care for losing their grip on reality, of literally not being that person used to know.
So it's interesting. From the outside, we think of caregiving as tasks, bathing, helping someone bathe, dress, groom, feed, and toilet. But those events in the course of the life of someone living with dementia are typically later in the course of the disease. For much of the disease, it's more about sort of getting into and wrapped up in the mind of the other person to basically put together a day that's safe, social, and engaged. So it becomes this sort of blending of selves in ways that become, quite frankly, difficult because one is becoming more impaired.
Right.
And if caregivers describe what I have picked up from the literature, as my colleague Andrew Peterson, who's a philosopher, George Mason, turned me onto this idea of ambiguous loss, this idea that it's like your relative goes off to sea and you don't know will they come back or not, or they go off to war. And caregivers begin to experience that the other person's mind is sort of there but not fully there, and yet some days better than others. And that word ambiguous loss, I think, captures that sort of psychological experience. So it's not just a task. It's a morally intense set of tasks. And I think the emphasis is on the moral intensity, which gets back to if we believe all those things, and I think everyone on the program here, all your listeners are, I would hope, agree with that, why is it as a society that we have failed to provide the necessary long-term care services and supports to these people engaging in this morally intense task? Why have we allowed the American family, the neither rich nor poor, the vast middle class, to bear the expenses of this disease that cause loss of employment and loss of income? I don't understand how the richest and most powerful nation in the world has allowed this to happen.
I don't know if this is true or not, but is it because we don't want to talk about old people or older people?
There's no question.
Or there's something about dementia
that is
so scary. There's
no question that the stigmas of the disease and the misunderstandings of the disease, cultural perceptions in the late 20th century were responsible for sort of not seeing this as a problem, not seeing it as a public problem. There's also no question that cultural assumptions that there will always be, dare I say, women to care, because that's, quote, what women do, baked into the role of being wife or mother, daughter-in-law, sister-in-law, to take care. Those cultural assumptions sort of kept dementia hidden as sort of a family problem managed by families, not a problem of society. It didn't help as well that because it was, quote, caused by senility, namely aging, that it wasn't a medical problem, so why should medicine care? Well, once culture began to change, and I chronicled this in the book towards the end of the 20th century, and you just can't simply assume, well, this is what women do, and getting old, and that's just the way it is, but instead we saw it as a disease taking away your autonomy, then culture has begun to pivot. And I do think now in the 21st century, I think no matter where one stands on the political spectrum, most, I hope, value self-determination and respect for autonomy. And a disease that takes away your ability to self-determine your life or enwraps you in someone else's life to have to help them self-determine, that's something that we should try to diagnose, treat, and support those who have disabilities. And that's the challenge, that's the problem of Alzheimer's that we face right now in America.
Do you think also because it's associated with mental illness? And we, you know, we've known, we not until, I mean, more recently, we don't do this. So we used to just put people in institutions out in the countryside so we didn't have to deal with them.
Asylums. Yeah. Well, I do think actually there's a role for asylums well done and designed for those who need them. And I write about that in the book. Having said that, you're right. The stigmas that surround mental illnesses, and Alzheimer's certainly is in the category of mental illnesses, although most of the advocates assiduously avoid calling it a mental illness because of the stigma. Having said that, the stigmas that surround the disease cause people to distance themselves from persons with the disease. That is what we call public stigma. And in the book, for example, I chronicle how Ronald Reagan, living at home in his house in California with dementia, his friend Walter Annenberg says, "I prefer to remember him as a vigorous fellow, and so I don't go and see him." So what Walter Annenberg, his former ambassador to the United Kingdom and friend, is saying is, "I'm staying away from Ronald Reagan, and presumably therefore Nancy Reagan, because I don't want to see him like that. I prefer to remember him as, quote, a vigorous fellow," whatever that means. Well, you know, that kind of attitude is what leads people to be isolated. On an individual basis, that causes suffering, but on a societal basis, that causes ignorance and lack of attention, lack of care. So we have to overcome the stigmas that surround this disease.
Well, we have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Brilliant. That is Jason Karlowish, our guest today on Radio Times. He's a professor of medicine, medical ethics, and health policy and neurology at the University of Pennsylvania, co-director of the Penn Memory Center, and he's got a new book. It's called The Problem of Alzheimer's, How Science, Culture, and Politics Turned a Rare Disease into a Crisis and What We Can Do About It. And we want to hear from you, especially if this sounds like something that you are dealing with. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Jason Karlowish about Alzheimer's disease. Here's an email from Beverly. She says, "I was the guardian and trustee for my brother who had dementia. Yes, I want a cure, but I'm furious at those who make money off the desperation of those who want anything that will help. I'm furious that the FDA ignored its statistician and its panel of outside experts and approved this drug that we've been talking about."
That's a poignant comment because she's lived through the worst of the diseases, guardian for her brother, and yet sees the larger social political forces that are at work here that shape what happens. Never underestimate the politics that surround this disease, given its vast size, scope, the money that's to be made, the money that's lost. Yeah.
But a number of advocacy groups are for this. I mean, it should be said, and I don't think they see dollar signs.
Well, that's the role of an advocacy group.
Right. And you want to leave it there rather than criticizing them? No. Okay. Yep. Fair enough. Help us understand the moving ahead. And I want to pick up on something you said earlier, right before the break, about the kind of loneliness, the idea that Annenberg didn't want to spend time with Ronald Reagan because he wanted to remember him before he got, I guess, Alzheimer's or dementia.
Preferred to remember him, when he was president. Right. Yeah.
Which raises questions about the pandemic and the effect of the pandemic on people.
COVID-19 was like everyone became Walter Annenberg and stayed away
forced.
Yeah, right. The COVID pandemic was an awful, awful natural experiment in what happens if you take away the ability to care for each other and or shoulder each other with the burdens of care, excuse the word, with no supports. And my colleague at the University of Pennsylvania, Emily Largent, who's a public policy lawyer in the Department of Medical Ethics Health Policy here, is doing a study of the impact of COVID on caregiving, and we'll be presenting some of those early results next month at the Alzheimer's meetings. But the bottom line is, you know, they reveal plainly how if you take away the long-term care services and supports people need, if you put people into isolation, they don't do well. In some sense, didn't we always know that? You know, banishment, solitary confinement were always viewed as punishments, or et cetera. But, you know, we hope from our study to better, as well as others that are going on, show the need for those kind of services and supports, the need to invest in them, et cetera. And there's no question. I mean, we saw at the Penn Memory Center sad stories of patients declining in both residential long-term care settings and at home because of the isolation and the removal of the supports they needed.
Even though someone will say, you know, I went to visit my father, my mother, my brother. They have Alzheimer's. They don't know who I am. I have to keep telling them, I'm your son, I'm your daughter, I'm your wife, I'm your partner, I'm your whatever.
Yeah.
So even though they don't feel like the person knows who they are, it's important to be there?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I mean, I think so. I think so, because we're doing a study by colleagues at Penn of the communication with persons with late-stage dementia. And what we're finding is that the mind of a person with dementia is present but not present. And there are episodes even of lucidity people have. Moreover, it is also about engagement with someone that just simply brings them pleasure. And I think we have to move beyond this idea of, do you remember me? What's my name? Do you remember me? I mean, when I met you at the studio, I didn't say, Marty, it's Jason. Do you remember me? Or, Marty, what's my name?
You know? I might have had to think for a moment.
Yeah, and, you know, vice versa. But we don't do that in normal social discourse. Why should we burden people with dementia? Uh-huh. What's my name? Who am I? I chronicle in the book the work of Ann Basting, a brilliant theater professor at the University of Wisconsin, who's written a book called Creative Care. And I think she charts a way to talk with persons living with dementia that doesn't demand reality therapy and doesn't engage in deception. And I would highly recommend folks have a look at Creative Care by Ann Basting.
What would be one piece of advice, though?
I'll give you the classic one.
Okay.
When's mom coming home? Well, wait a minute. Mother's been dead for 50, 60 years. Right. Wait, this is, what do we do here? Do we tell him that mother's been dead for 50, 60 years? Or do we lie and say, oh, she'll be home in 20 minutes? Or do we say instead, what is it about mom that you miss the most? And then have a question about let's just talk about mother. So those questions, which oftentimes are quite disturbing, we ought to get married, but we are married. Or whose house is this? Or when are we going home? You know, yes, one approach is to tell the truth, and the truth's a good thing. And sometimes it's like, okay, fine. But sometimes the truth doesn't work. It causes distress, et cetera, or repetitious questions. So instead engage in a creative conversation about what is it that we love about mother. Hmm. You can talk about what we love about mother even though mother's dead.
Right. I mean, that gives them a kind of dignity of their
exactly.
of their experience, right?
Exactly. And it is about dignity and removing stigma. And I do want to point out, we've done work led by a psychologist in our group, Shana Stites, dedicated towards better understanding stigma in Alzheimer's disease. And the chief driver of that stigma is the prognosis. That is to say, once you hear that word, you associate it with the worsening of the disease in those later stages, and that spills over into all stages of the disease. Dr. Stites has even shown in persons who have only a biomarker evidence of the disease, they still are going to experience the stigmas of Alzheimer's, even though they have no disability, and it's because of that perception. And so I think it all the more raises this we need, dare I say, a cultural cure for this disease, that is to say, change the ways we talk about it. So I'll give you one example in my own personal and professional life. If you had outed me on this show, I don't know, 5-6 years ago, I would have been talking about the demented. Well, amongst those who are demented or the demented, I don't say that. And I've noticed my colleagues as well don't talk that way either. What we say instead is among persons living with dementia. So we're trying to transform the adjectival where you are that thing to that's just a quality of you, but it is not you. Mm. And that kind of language change isn't just a branding and rebranding. It is a beginning of a turning in the way you think about what it means to have dementia and to live with it and to care for someone with the disease.
Yeah. It's about identity, right?
Well, it is about identity. I mean, fundamentally, this is a disease of identity. I mean, early on, it's a relentless attack upon privacy, identity, and self-determination. And the irony, of course, of the disease is that early on, we have to give up some degree of privacy, let others monitor us. We have to give up some degree of, if you will, or transform some nature of our identity. But I would argue that if that's done in a way that respects dignity, it can be done in a way that I think maintains the person, as opposed to turns them into just a person with the demented.
Here's a question going back to what we were talking about earlier about this FDA drug. This is from Pearl. Are there adverse side effects with the newly approved drug?
Yeah.
How did the presence or absence of side effects influence the FDA's approval despite the poor data on the drug's efficacy?
Well, the drug does have side effects. It causes small leakages of fluid in the brain and or hemorrhages. The term for those is ARIA. It's an abbreviation, ARIA. And it's about a third of the patients who receive the drug experience those. You're more likely to have them if you have a copy of the APOE4 gene, which also increases your risk of getting dementia as well. Persons on the drug need scans of their brain with an MRI to detect those small microscopic hemorrhages.
You mentioned institutions, and you said, you know, you have some ideas about, I guess, not the kind of, you know, snake pits that we associate with mental institutions, but a way of thinking about how to create a quality of life for people with Alzheimer's disease. What would that look like?
So there comes a time in the course of dementia when the disabilities become advanced enough and the changes in cognition can lead someone to simply find that they're living what I call a home loose life. They're not homeless, but they're home loose. They're so unlimbered from a sense of home in the place that they're in, and their caregiver also, that really a new home is needed. And I think there's truly a role for the asylum as what we mean asylum truly means, as a place of refuge, retreat, and sanctuary. And I do think I actually don't agree with the rhetoric, and I call it rhetoric, of those who advocate for long-term care services and supports that it should, quote, all be in the community and all be home-based. There's no question that it should be home-based, but there is no question as well that for some people, particularly people with advanced dementia, home no longer is working, and that's where an asylum is needed. Now, in America, that means, quote, a nursing home. And in America, a nursing home means an entity often run for profit, cutting the costs as best as they can in order to maximize the profits. So the solution isn't to, quote, shut down the nursing homes and return people to their homes. The solution is to have better nursing homes that really care for people who have disabling cognitive impairments. So I think that the national dialogue around long-term care services and supports needs to sort of back off the, you know, close the nursing homes, our homes, not nursing homes rhetoric. For some persons, particularly persons with disabling cognitive impairments, home isn't working. And what we're doing, if we're advocating for care only in the home, is we're telling the caregivers, you're going to be, this is your life, this asylum. And I just don't think that that's acceptable as a matter of social policy.
Is there a design? I mean, it's in terms of making a
home that works.
A home that works.
Yeah.
I mean, what does it need?
So in America, you know, we're in this weird sort of how to design a nursing home that works. And
exactly.
There's this sort of trend in architecture and design that says, let's build a nursing home that's like Philadelphia in 1955. Decorations, signposts, magazines, newspapers, photographs of Rizzo. And you're like, all right, I get the nostalgia thing. I get the sort of, you know, they remember the past better than the present. But isn't this kind of weird? Like we're sort of lying to them and pretending that this is what we... And it starts to be like a performance. And, you know, say, well, what's the alternative? Make them look like some sterile hospital and whatnot? Well, no. What about taste? What about the fact that some, you know, you don't design your, you decorate your house to fit a taste. So why don't we think of, and there are models, for example, in the Netherlands of, for example, adult day activity programs where this is designed for people who like a rural life. It's located in a woodsy area. The furnishings and whatnot look rural. Whereas this place is designed for people who like a more urban, classical setting and with furniture and decorations that are more neoclassical, et cetera. Mm. Isn't that kind of what we like in life? We have our tastes. I mean, I kind of asked one of these guys who built a place that looks like Ohio in 1950. Well, what are you going to do in 15 years? because the residents will be like, what the heck is this old place?
Yeah, you know?
It's like every 20 years we're going to have to reboot it. Moreover, Philadelphia 1950. So which Philadelphia are we going to celebrate? We got to celebrate the Rizzo Philadelphia. We got to celebrate the West Philadelphia. So it's I have real problems with sort of, you know, nostalgia communities that are built essentially on an architectural lie of let's make it look like, you know, we're back whenever.
Let me go back to actually the beginning of is it Alois Alzheimer?
Yeah, Alois Alzheimer's.
Yeah, who's the person who discovered, you know,
yes,
quotation marks
six
here.
6-foot-some-odd tall German psychiatrist.
Yeah, you know. Tell us about him. What do we need to know about him?
Fascinating guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He liked his beer. He married wealth. And because he married wealth, he was able to fund his research. There was no grant funding back then. He was German. All his colleagues were German. And he was onto some brilliant discoveries. He actually began to question the idea that dementia in an older adult was caused by extreme aging. He was questioning the senility label. And if you read the writings of him and his colleagues, they were really onto something. And by 1914, had they continued their research, I think they probably would have upended the idea that senility is extreme aging and with their microscopy studies. The problem was he was German. And they were all German.
Right.
And in 1914, Germany made a decision along with the rest of Europe to let's go to war. What was supposed to be a walk in the park, like most wars, doesn't turn out that way.
Right.
And in Germany, the rest is truly history. I mean, in the early 20th century, Germany was a powerhouse of medical science. Most of the Nobel Prizes were won by Germans. But Germany just fell apart. And by 1930, I mean, it was a wreck. There is an unsung hero in the early history of Alzheimer's, Oskar Fischer. He was German national. He was a Jew. And he did some of the best work around amyloid. And he lost his university position in the 1920s because of anti-Semitism. He would be captured. He would be later imprisoned by the Nazis and killed.
Wow.
And he deserves to be, I think, re-recognized as one of the founders of the field, Oskar Fischer. Yeah.
Were they also up against Sigmund Freud, who thought about, diseases from childhood traumas,
Sigmund
right?
Freud hated America. So he's very anti-American, very big European snob. But after the First World War, and certainly by the end of the Second World War, psychodynamic theories of mental illness dominated psychiatry, and biological psychiatry that was advanced by Alzheimer's had faded from prominence. And America became enamored with Freudian theories of illness to the exclusion of problems like dementia, which didn't lend themselves to a psychodynamic theory. And there's no question that really the 20th century were kind of the dark ages for this because of both the collapse of German science and the rise of Freudianism kind of just left dementias and older adults kind of ignored and just kind of a private family problem to be dealt with by families, which then got back to what we talked earlier, that meant women, and it gets wrapped up in some interesting stories there.
So what do you think the 21st century holds for Alzheimer's disease?
I think the 21st century is going to be a century of progress, but I am concerned given the events of recent times. Having said that, the events of the last few years in drug development have been very inspiring. I realize there hasn't been a new drug in 15, 20 years, but in the last several years, the progress of studies that target the pathology are very encouraging, but I think we need to be a little patient. I think we're in a very difficult national conversation about what we're going to do about long-term care services and supports. In the last election, President Trump had no platform on this topic. President Biden does, and is attempting as part of his infrastructure package to address it. But there's more work to be done in that space. Mm-hmm. I don't know how long America can go pretending, unlike other countries, to not have any long-term care services and supports like Germany, like Japan, et cetera. This is a private hidden cost on the American family. It's getting rougher and rougher.
Well, I really appreciate you joining us on
thanks
Radio
so much
Times.
For having
appreciate
me.
Your work, and thanks for being a guest on Radio Times.
It was a lot of fun. Thank you, everyone.
You're very welcome. And that is Jason Karlowish. Again, he's got a new book, The Problem of Alzheimer's. He's a professor of medicine, medical ethics and health policy and neurology at the University of Pennsylvania, and he's co-director of the Penn Memory Center. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. You can find us on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show produced by Debbie Bilder, Kelsey Hansen, and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.